is a special presentation of the Buccaneers Sports Network. This is the Jay and Keith Show. Two broadcasters, two microphones, and one meticulously scripted podcast.
You what?
Just kidding. Get it, JK? You get it.
That's what I thought was so funny! It's not funny!
Alongside Keith Bray, here's the voice of the Bucs, Jay Sandoz.
All right, very exciting Jay and Keith Show. Yeah. Coming off an exciting men's basketball win against the Mercer Bears. Women open up conference play today. As we record on a Thursday, they'll be at UNCG, then Saturday at Western Carolina. I think tonight's at 7, I know, and 1 o'clock, right? The Western women's game? Pretty sure. If not,
I'll sounds out. Right, yeah.
If not, I'll correct myself in a minute, but yes.
Down in Colo.
And that'll be part, I think Mercer men play right after that, so it's a double header for the Western Carolina Catamounts.
That would explain the early start, yeah.
And then for ETSU men's basketball, Saturday they will take on the Citadel, which we'll talk about maybe here in a minute, too.
It is 1 p.m. for women's basketball down in Cullowhee.
The woulda, shoulda, coulda game for the Citadel because they had Furman. Second year in a row, they've had them on the ropes and lost in overtime. Second year in a row in overtime at home.
No, the worst part, Jay, is that the Citadel had two looks for the win. Fox missed a free throw line jumper, and then they got an offensive rebound. I can't remember who it was. And he missed the putback. And that was their chance. And then Furman had a look at the end of regulation to try to win it themselves. They missed it, went to overtime. But if the Citadel had two chances to get in there and make it happen, and they didn't do it.
They had a shot last year to end the game in regulation.
Yeah, because, Pegues hit one in the last, 2 seconds to force overtime.
I'm sorry. In overtime, it was 5-6 seconds to go. Mm-hmm. Furman missed a free throw, and he got the rebound, and Citadel never could foul him in the last 5 seconds. And again, that's right.
So it was,
the Citadel twice has had an opportunity to knock off Furman at home and not been able to do it.
Oh, no, it was Davidson. It was Paxton Davidson that had the free throw line jumper, and he missed it. And then just crashing in out of absolute thin air, Christian Moore gets the offensive board, tries to reverse it in, and he missed it too strong. Furman comes out the other side. Vanderwall doesn't hit the right elbow jumper, and we go to overtime, and Furman wins. And you just knew that that was the moment, right? That was the moment that the Citadel was waiting for, and they couldn't make it happen. And it just, what do you got to do? There you go.
They were great games last night.
They were pretty good games last night. The other one was Wofford and Western Carolina.
Yeah, Wofford pulled away last 2 minutes.
Yeah, I was amazed to go back and look at the box score and see that Jeremy Lorenz had 4 points and 3 rebounds in that game because it felt like he was everywhere. It really felt like he was just all over the place. Filowich had another double double. Tripp was really good. Bailey was good again. Justin Bailey got it going too. He hit 4 threes, and they led, I think, pretty much wire to wire in that game. Wofford did, and won it 77-69. And they're now 2-1 in the league, as is ETSU. And if you didn't know that, because you didn't see the last 8 seconds, well, that's okay. Nobody did, except for Jay. We have to get you to verify that those last 8.8 seconds were played.
They were. I was told it was as Bugs was walking to the free throw.
Correct.
Line. So, Bugs misses the first, hits the second. Mercer has a timeout, does not use it after the make. So, it's down to 8 seconds to go. Robinson dribbles top of the key as fast as he can. Bucks switch it. So it was Caron Boyd on Robinson. Then Sisk now takes up run. So instead of what they've been doing is kind of running through the screens and trailing, going under, doing whatever they could. But because of the time situation, wasn't sure if they were going to drive for two, shoot for three. Bucks switch for the first time in the game, put Sisk on Robinson. Robinson, who I appropriately, I believe, named Hero Wannabe, because he took the shot before, which was not a great one, probably, and he had not had a great game. He's a great player, but he had not had a great game. And he, when they do the switch with Sisk, He takes a jab, step forward, step back, pump fake. Sis stays down on the first one. And at that point, then Robinson has no other shot but to shoot it. The block by Sis kind of shoots it straight up in the air. And I want to say Wheeler had it with about a second to go. Somebody kind of knocked it away, and then Bugs tracked it down. I want to say it was John Bugs tracked it down for the last, like, 0.6. Dribbled one time, and it got through the ball in the air, and it was over, and ETSU victorious.
Oh, yeah!
And let me say this about John Bugs. I said a post-game, I'll say it again. He had about as rough a game as John Bugs is going to have, but he had probably three of the biggest plays in the game. The offensive rebound, the kick back to Peterson for the go-ahead three at that time.
Yes.
Then he had the big defensive rebound where he went in amongst the trees and came down with it, got
yep.
fouled. And in the last point, 6.8, he ends up with the ball to dribble out to win the game. So it goes to show you, if it's not your day, you can do other things to help your team win.
And I appreciate it, because you could tell on the telecast, Bugs did not hang his head. Like, his body language stayed locked in the whole time. He knew the shots weren't falling, but he knew he could find a way to contribute. And I appreciated that. I think that's something that it's so easy, especially when your game is predicated on the three-point shot and those three-point shots aren't falling, to kind of sulk your way through a basketball game a little bit. But Bugs didn't do that, and he stayed in it like a veteran should, and he made some veteran plays. And so I think that's something that ETSU desperately needed. For a guy that did not hit a field goal for the first time this year, was integral to ETSU winning the basketball game. But Kimari Peterson, yeah, the huge second chance three with 18 seconds left, scored 7 of the team's final 14 points, and a great to see Gabe Sisk put it together and have a solid game. Career high 29 minutes, actually has now been charted with 11 rebounds. They went back and changed it and gave Sisk another rebound and credit for that block shot you were talking about. When I looked at the box score earlier today, he had not been scored with that. So that is a change. At some point today, they gave him the block shot. So it's actually a career-high 11 rebounds, which means the pregame report for Saturday is wrong. And
it's not your fault.
No. But Kevin already has it, so it's going to be there. Because it was the information I had at the time. It's what I had at the time.
Well, and I still think I had Cisco 11 points, but I don't want to bring it up to Kevin because I don't write down when guys score. And on the bus ride, everyone was just, you know, having a great time because you're about to ride 6 hours. But
after a road win.
The old vitamin W on the bus was flowing. It was great. And, guys were feeling good. And much needed win. But, yes, the 11, and I think, you know, Coach Savage said it postgame. I think he mentioned it to Kevin, not me. Pregame that he told Sisk he's going to play a lot and he thinks he can have a double-double on this team, and Sisk kind of chuckled at him. And matter of fact, Sisk walked by me on the bus and I said, well, look at you all grown up today.
Ah!
And he that's kind of was his response too. He kind of laughed a little.
Wow.
He goes, yeah, I got wow. He said, I played good today.
So, well, it's, yeah, you know, Sisk has had such an up-and-down sophomore year, as the sophomore year is wont to be. But there'll be 3 or 4 possessions in a row where he does stuff that makes you think, holy cow, this guy is the future. And then he'll dribble it off his leg, and he'll make a bad pass, and he just won't be in the right spot to catch. And then it just kind of goes sideways on him. But to see it come together for him more or less last night was just nice. Because he's a really nice guy. He's a smart basketball player for the most part. I think he's a really good kid. And obviously, he's not just rolling over and giving up. He continues to work hard. And I think, you know, especially with a need for minutes, depending on how long Davion Bradford is out, they're going to need some additional minutes somewhere off the bench. It's not all going to come from DJ Hughes. They're going to find some different looks, maybe with more Jaden Seymour at the 5, to try to give the other team different looks and get the best matchups that you can in the post. Well, that's going to open up some floor time for a guy like Sisk, and I think he earned it with a solid performance against Mercer. So I'm excited to see him go up against the Citadel, a team that he scored 10 points against in February of
24. The way the direction this team got, by the way, the bounce back, we talked about that too, the resilience.
Absolutely.
The bounce back. They had an opportunity late game. Wofford didn't quite go. late game, similar situation, down four, able to get, again, two steals. This time it was Peterson to assist for the first bucket. Then it was Peterson with a steal and a score himself. I mean, that there's something to be said about that press. Like, when the Bucks are against backs against the wall, man, they are unbelievable pressing basketball team. And made plays two games in a row. It is, you know, I've talked to Coach Savage about that off air again. It's just, they're not really built. And you just can't, your team's not built to do that. It's tough to do that a lot. Like, you can pick your spots. And certainly when you're down, you're forced into a situation. But to me, that's even better because you don't show it until the very end. And, yeah, people may, like, okay, well, they may press us here. Here's how we're going to work on it. But to me, there's just something different. When you get Sisk on the ball, you get Peterson or Struthers guarding the point guard. Everyone's kind of playing floater or guarding whoever. I mean, it's just an unbelievable. But the resiliency to come back against Wofford falls short and then to not let that affect them the next game, right? Because a Wofford loss is going to cost you two games, that's for sure. The other thing I want to say is that Mercer looked a part of a very good basketball team. I think they will be a very good basketball team. They're going to beat a lot of teams and throw a lot of monkey wrenches into what everyone had preseason. Alex Holt's pretty good inside. Chip Johnson can flat out score. I think he should have got more shots. Ahmad Robinson's probably not going to go 3 for 16 again.
Mercer led that game for 3 minutes and 54 seconds.
Well, they led 3-2, I think. I don't think they led again.
For 50 seconds. They led 3-2 for 50 seconds, and then they took the lead again at 61-58 with 3:54 to go.
Yeah.
And then they led it until Peterson hit to make it 69-68 with 18 seconds left. So I actually did the math wrong. That is what? 54, that's 30.
Now you're doing
six. So 336 plus 50 is 386. So it's actually 426. So they led for 4 minutes and 26 seconds of the ballgame. At home. That tells me a lot about the way ETSU played that ballgame last night. That is about as good of a road win as you can ask for in terms of performance and in terms of just keeping the visiting team behind you, keeping them trying to chase you down. That's a great spot to be in. And ETSU 9-7, 2-1 in the SoCon, and now in a four-way tie for third with Furman, Mercer, and Wofford. Wofford beat Western last night, and Furman beat the Citadel. And ETSU takes on the Citadel on Saturday.
An interesting game tonight is Chattanooga and Greensboro.
Yes, it is.
Because Greensboro's either going to – if Greensboro wins, they're 3-0, and Chatt falls to 1-2. But if Chatt were to win, that puts both teams at 2-1.
Which means there would be
gaggle.
Six teams at 2-1 at that point.
And as much as I would love to give VMI a puncher's chance, they're on the road at Sanford. I will not give them a puncher's chance. Sanford probably wins by 25, and they go to 3-0.
That's rough. That's rough, buddy. But, yeah, that's what's coming up at ETSU. Taking on the Citadel. This is a Citadel team. It's decent. The portal has been kind to them. They got a D3 transfer. Fox, who's really good at that level and is the fifth leading scorer in SoCon, Brody Fox. And then also they have a really good rebounder, fourth in the SoCon in rebounding, in Sola Adebisi, who was 2 years as a walk-on at Florida State. And those two guys are players they got in the portal that they were hoping would be major contributors, and they have been for Ed Conroy's group. This team turns the ball over way too much. I think ETSU should win this game. They should win it fairly comfortably. But, I mean, also, I would have thought that Furman would have rolled them. But Furman on the road just seems to be a little bit of a different beast when it's in SoCon play. And it's the second straight year that Citadel's taking them to the wire in Charleston. At some point, you kind of get that itch, right, of we got to find a way to win one. And you come out with a little extra fire, and that's all it takes in the SoCon. So ETSU can't just show up and roll. I do think they need to be there with a plan of attack and a lot of energy. But if you come out of the gate strong against this team and you can get a big lead early, then you'll be in a great position and find yourself a way to win the game.
Yeah, you know, Citadel's going to be a tough out because, again, the new transfer rules and everything. We talked about it on the coaches show. If we can go back and listen to that, talk to Coach Savage about that. But new transfer rules, and now they're taking undergraduate transfers that don't have to wear the uniform, can live off campus. And a couple-year experiment. obviously a lot of the old guard is not a fan of that.
I would imagine not.
I hear the general right now is not a fan of it, but we'll see if they win some games. Maybe that changes their mind. Maybe it goes away. But for right now, Coach Conover has done a great job of not just trying to get graduate transfers, but finding other undergraduates. So football as well, more straight. And I think baseball was allowed as well. So not every sport was allowed to do it, but there are three or four sports that were. And so those sports are trying to take advantage and do a test run. But Citadel, I think it'll be tough, especially because Coach Conroy, you know, was the mentor to Brooke Savage, not just summer camps, but when he worked for him at Tulane. And so, you know, these are always those fun kind of teacher-student moments. But it's at home. ETSU needs to try to get to 3-1. If we would have said, hey, first four games, three are at home, one's at Mercer, if you were 3-1, certainly you would want 4-0. You know, you probably could have maybe penciled in, hey, we think ETSU would be 4-0. But if you said you could be 3-1 going into maybe your two toughest road games of the year.
You're in the hunt, yeah.
At Furman.
I live with it.
Yeah, because I mean, if you go 2-2, and then you still got to go to Furman, you still got to go to Sanford. Furman, a place you hardly ever win at ever. Now, that's at Timmins. That this game's going to be at Bon Secours. We're not going to break down those games because we'll talk about them next week. And then you've had good success at Sanford, not the last 2 years, but you've had good success winning in Homewood. Your problem against Sanford's been winning at home. It's been a dominated by the road team. But still, you get this game Saturday 3-1. You give yourself a shot to kind of stay in the hunt as opposed to 2-2, taking on two of the toughest games. And this is a good stretch, I think, for Sanford to see, are they going to be able to run away and hide? They play VMI. Then they've got UNCG at home. Then they're at Mercer. And then I think it's ETSU. I think that's the next third. Yes.
Right.
Yeah. So if they were able to rattle those off, that's a good jump start to the league.
Yeah. Women's basketball, ETSU takes on UNCG tonight. It's about 4 hours away as we have this conversation. And UNCG, always tough to beat at Fleming. You know, it's kind of a weird environment. It's very intimate. It's usually not a huge crowd, especially not this time of year. The Spartans are 7-0 at home this season. So ETSU going to have to go in there and do something really special to dislodge Jade Gamble and that group. And Gamble is the player to watch, in my mind. She's had an outstanding season and is, I think, a clear player of the year candidate, if not the front runner for player of the year right now with what she's been able to contribute. I think A.C. Carter has been really good at Western Carolina, but a lot of that is offense. I haven't had a good chance to watch the Catamounts just yet, but there have been some impressive players that have come through, and they were actually returners. A.C. Carter and Tyja Beans were on that team last year, and Jonathan Sippas has them bought in and playing a fun brand of basketball. So very curious to see how that goes. It's opening night in the league in women's hoops in the Southern Conference. So ETSU is at UNCG tonight. Chattanooga is at Western Carolina. And then the rest of the SoCon kicks in on Saturday with Sanford at Mercer and Furman at Wofford. Well, Chattanooga's at UNCG and ETSU's at Western Carolina.
Yeah, again, it's so tough for the women because if you're four teams are going to start this league play and four still got to sit and wait, I mean, it's just unfortunate that that's kind of the situation and you just there's not enough teams to not have that happen. So.
I don't want to do this again.
I know.
We can do it.
I'm not.
We can.
No, I'm not.
We can.
I'm not. I'm gonna stay happier. I'm sure there's other things we can talk about.
Fitter, happier, and more productive. That's what I'm trying to be.
That's off-season talk.
Let's fitter, happier, and more productive. Well, I am getting fit. I started a 30-day yoga challenge on Tuesday. I've been just beginner yoga, just trying to get it started. And this morning I woke up and my back hurt, but it was like that ache of like the satisfaction of a good lift. I know you wouldn't know what that's like because you haven't done that in a long time. But you know, like there's that feeling in your muscles like this hurts a little bit, but it's for a good cause. And so yeah, I feel pretty good.
I did not do any of that.
No. You want to talk to a fitness junkie? This guy, absolutely. I mean, he's just constantly at the CPA. I always see him with his gym bag. he is...
I just thought he likes wearing athletic shorts to work.
Well, I mean, that's a convenient cover, right? Oh, yeah, I'm going to work out. Yeah, it's a reason. Well, I guess it's a reason, not an excuse, right? A man full of reasons with no excuses. Eric Baumgartner is the... Well, I don't know what his exact title is. He'll tell us on the Jay and Keith Show, presented by First Horizon. Edition of Portal Watch, we are joined by the Watcher of the Portal, the Heimdall of ETSU athletics, if you like. I don't know, Norse mythology? No? Nothing? Eric Baumgartner is Associate AD for Compliance. Is that your title?
Technically now it's Executive Senior Associate AD.
Executive Senior Associate AD.
There we go. What a name. What a dropper.
Wow.
What a dropper.
Yeah, just fire that title right off. That's a mouthful. We know him as the compliance guy, the guy that we never want to hear from, but also always want to hear from, Eric Baumgartner. Eric, it's good to see you. Thanks so much for joining us. How was your holidays now that the transfer portal doesn't stay open all the way through the holidays for fall sports? I would imagine it was a little bit quieter this time of year.
Well, Keith, Jay, thanks for having me. But unfortunately, the portal for football in particular stayed open until December 28th.
Ooh.
So there were a last few moment phone calls from some of our
sure
student athletes who wanted to dive in on that last day. So
what is the transfer portal? Because I think when you think about that, you think about like Stargate or some futuristic technological thing. I think isn't it just a password protected spreadsheet?
Well, it's what Dr. Pepper made it in their commercials.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the vortex, the wormhole from Deep Space Nine, yeah.
Yeah, so basically the portal became a destination for student-athletes who wanted to transfer to other institutions. So it put the onus on the school they're leaving to put them in a public, meaning an institutional membership database so we all could see someone getting in rather than a school or another school and not another school. So some schools getting the release, others not getting the release and not having a fair shot at said prospective student athlete now. So the portal is a database where all of us member institutions can access and see if Keith Brake has gone in the portal to come to East Tennessee State University.
Which I did.
Yes.
At Western Kentucky, actually, in
you
2009.
Did.
Yeah.
Jay was hit with tampering, but
it was a player to be named later, and we've not given him the player back, so I don't know what statute of limitations.
Well, I didn't work for you. Yeah, I didn't even know who you were. I didn't know.
Whoa.
In 2009?
You knew who I was.
In 2009? I didn't know.
Everybody did.
Yeah, sure.
I was more worried about the speeding ticket I got on my last trip through Kentucky. but at any rate, how much, from your perspective, has the transfer portal affected what you do? Because you've obviously been working in compliance for much longer than there has been a transfer portal. Has this streamlined things where student-athletes moving in and out of institutions have a little bit of a smoother ride, and is it a smoother administrative process now, even though maybe it's increased the number of student-athletes that are moving around?
Yes. The reason it increased, obviously, was the removal of the one-time transfer.
Absolutely.
So it certainly takes away writing a letter or typing up a letter to give to a student-athlete to then send it all to all schools that she may want to. So ultimately, once a student athlete sends us an email and they watch the required NCAA video and complete the questionnaire and complete a couple loose ends here at ETSU, we're happy to put them in, and then they can go about their business at another school.
Are you kind of the first and last person that a student athlete sees when they're coming to the institution? Like when people are coming in via the portal, they've committed to a coach, a team. When they get to campus, at what point in their onboarding, quote-unquote, process do you sit down with them and talk about getting them enrolled and getting them situated here?
Fortunately, we've got a good team here with the Student Athlete Success Group, our coaching staffs, and the compliance office. We all collaborate to get said student athlete Keith Brake ready to go. So there are NCAA and ETSU required forms. staff gets them enrolled, and then obviously the football staff or whatever staff, soccer, volleyball, I'm trying to think who else came in, are all getting them ready to go. So from a compliance standpoint, they do have to complete their forms, and we have beginning of the semester meetings, or beginning of the team meetings, for example. In the summer, we meet with football and soccer before school begins, but when the other sports come in, we meet with them before they can start practice.
The big thing, too, with that, working with SAS, which I love the new name change, by the way.
Yes, that was a great acronym. I don't know if that was you or Jess Thomas or collaboration or what, but we love it.
I think we'll go with Jess, Lauren, and Doc on that one.
Okay.
So the student, what is it, student academic success?
Student athlete success suite.
Yeah, sure. So
you used to have an office.
I did. They kicked me out because they wanted success and then and academics, and so I had neither. So they took me out of that. But I want to stay with academics because that's another tweak that comes in with so many kids transferring out, or because it's not just helping kids come in and making sure, you know, all the credits are transferring and they're meeting whatever NCAA. It's also helping those students that are going somewhere else getting their stuff in line. How much of a burden, because you have to see some of that too, correct? Now, they do the bulk of the work, but then you've got to come in and do, and I know you probably got a full week set aside at certain times to do that, but how tough is that added, you know, again to the job to try to make sure that not just the, let's say, 150 new athletes coming in, you got 300 athletes you're trying to make sure that you're doing right by.
Yeah. So for our transfer process, our sports submitted through our database, our own, we call it ARMS, through TeamWorks, and they submit it to us in compliance, and I review it and then create a transfer evaluation form. That, fortunately, we've got great collaboration with our admissions office, our registrar's office, that they review it to see what classes will transfer in from admissions, and then that moves over to our registrar's office, who then determines whether or not they meet PTD here, progress toward degree, at East Tennessee State. So depending on what year the student athlete is in, their first 2 years, any credit can come in, but after that fourth semester or their fifth semester coming in, they have to meet certain percentage requirements of the degree they're interested here at ETSU.
And I think that's the one thing when you see it a lot and people say, well, he was going there, but it was an academic thing. I think a lot of people go to, well, they were failing classes and things, and that's not usually it's not even close to the case, because if they're already transferring, that means they probably had grades to transfer. It's more about the credit hours, majors, other things that each school or state may have some things that people have to meet here and there. And so I think sometimes the athletes do get a bad rap on that. And we've all seen it where guys going there, well, something about couldn't get in school or academically. But again, I go with most of the time it has nothing to do with them passing or failing. It's what you were talking about with the credit hours, degrees, and other things.
That's right. So the good piece of that educational part or academic part is maybe Jay Sanders isn't meeting PTD at East Tennessee State, meaning he didn't meet 40%, but if he went to Virginia Tech and now you meet 47%, you could come in and be eligible. So everything but the PTD is needed at the school you're leaving. So if someone didn't pass their 6 hours in a semester or 18 hours in a year, it could vary, but a lot of times it's each individual school and their departments that have more, you know, stringent information that they need for their classes.
In general, kind of with a broad brush, is it easier or harder to get people situated with PTD the longer they've been at a previous institution and racked up credit hours there? Because I know when I transferred here after my freshman year at Western Kentucky, I had 3 or 4 classes that did not transfer. Like they were electives, they were non-credit electives, they were considered remedial. Like there were things that I did that were baseline general electives, or not general electives, gen eds at one institution that did not translate to the other.
Yeah, we come across that. My oldest son, he came out across here too as well. He probably lost 15 to 20 credits coming from James Madison just because, again, different schools and different requirements. And, yeah, there are a lot of times students lose hours. Now, here at ETSU, we require your last 30 hours to be earned at ETSU. So if someone is in their ninth or tenth semester, they're already automatically going to lose hours because the most it will take is 90 hours. So, yes, yeah, so someone coming in earlier, junior and below, will have a better opportunity to transfer in just because of institutional policy of 90 hours at ETSU. Some other schools that I've worked at, 60 hours had to be earned at that school. So someone who may be a junior would have lost 15 to 20 hours on top of that because the most Virginia would take in would be 60 hours.
A lot of things, I think, too, come into play because you have the either in football, the four-game red shirt, you have COVID years, you have very less strenuous medical, mental health, whatever waivers that guys can get, 7-8, I'm sure folks, well, we're not throwing stones, we had our own guy. So what's interesting about that is a lot of times you make the joke of, well, you should have been a doctor by now, but a lot of times some of those things that transferly come in, right, so it may take you an extra year to get your undergraduate, some people may get a master's, but now a lot of schools and even some private schools are coming up with ways to do certificates. So can you walk me through the certificate and how that's different in there? Just, I mean, I vaguely know, but I find this interesting because this is how a lot of the student athletes post graduation that have an undergraduate degree are kind of going so that they can not have to be tied into school for multiple years, but maybe a 12-month, 9-month period.
Right. So going back to, we'll talk about the NCAA philosophy first. We want student athletes to earn their degree. And so roughly 5 years ago, we as a membership said, all right, if a student athlete earns their bachelor's degree, let them choose what they want to do after that, whether it's a second baccalaureate, whether it's seeking a master's degree or the certificate programs. So yes, fortunately here at ETSU, we've got several certificate programs. A lot of our student athletes go for one of the sport management certificates or coaching certificates where, you know, again, as a graduate student, which they would be, all you really have to do is pass 6 hours a semester and you're eligible the next term. And that's ultimately what the NCAA is focusing on, getting your first degree. And then after that, if you're back in school, getting a certificate where it's not hard as maybe getting a master's, but you're still doing coursework, but it's a certificate rather than a specific master's of something.
I got one more here, and then I'll let Keith jump back in with some stuff. Other thing I find interesting is how kids are tied to APR depending on when they transfer out of schools, because some people can transfer in and you're on the hook for the APR of if they graduate. Some you aren't. Can you kind of clear that up? Because I think, again, that throws a little bit of some of those calculations or people's like, well, we had a 3.5, all these people graduated, but there could have been somebody transfer out, didn't graduate, so that goes against you. So kind of talk us through your math of having to figure that out.
Sure.
For the APRs.
So what Jay's referring to is called the academic progress rate that the NCAA put in the early 2000s. And so that what that measures is every student athlete on athletics aid, were they eligible in the term, and did they return? So we look at the eligibility point and the retention point. So depending on each semester a student athlete is on aid, so conceivably if someone's here a year, they would have ultimately 4 points they could earn. So again, did Keith earn his eligibility point? Did he pass the 6 hours in a term? And then coming into spring semester, did he come back? Yes, so that's 2 for 2 coming out of the fall semester. Then we look to after spring. Did Keith earn his 18 hours in the academic year as an upperclassman? Yes, so he earned his eligibility point check. Did he come back? If he did, then he'd be 4 for 4. If Keith didn't come back, by definition, we lose that retention point. So he would be 3 for 4. So then we'd have to look for where did Keith go? Did Keith go to another 4-year school? If so, great, check. We can remove that retention point because you've landed at another school. So then you'd be a 3 for 3. If you go to a junior college, you have to have a 3.3 GPA. So, again, if you didn't have a 3.3 leaving ETSU, but you went to a junior college, we would lose that point. So then you would be a 3 for 4. So, yes, we take every student athlete on athletics aid by team, and we calculate their APR. So, again, a smaller program like golf and tennis, they have very slim margin of error. Because if one student athlete leaves, you go from 1,000, which is a perfect score, to possibly 980. Where our big sports like football or track, flexibility if they lose two or three student-athletes from eligibility or retention. And so then, ultimately, we look at our institutional APR. So the NCAA has given financial incentives for APR that if you have higher than a 985 institutional APR, then you can receive some academic-based revenue, which is pretty significant as a result of the CBS, TBS, men's basketball contracts.
And that determines some revenue sharing as well. That's why that's important. That's why I brought that up, yes. Because that is something that can level a little bit of playing field and revenue sharing for schools, mid-majors like Southern Conference schools, yep. Where they can actually earn some money back from the NCAA because of that.
That's right. That's okay. Exactly right.
So one of the main reasons I wanted to bring you on, Eric, is the situation with junior colleges and additional years of eligibility. The NCAA has issued a blanket waiver for athletes who attended a junior college, see if I'm explaining this right, attended a junior college at some point during their eligibility clock, which is a five-year period where you enroll at a degree-granting institution and your clock starts and you have 5 years to play four. The NCAA has said if you competed at a junior college at some point in that span and your eligibility would have expired after this season, you now have a waiver to get an extra year for 2025-26. This all stems from Diego Pavia and his appeal for an additional year. What can you tell us about what the NCAA has communicated to institutions about this? First of all, do I have it right? And second of all, what's the NCAA delivering to you and to your peers in the SoCon as guidance for how to implement this?
Sure. Yeah, what you stated was correct. So it's basically every student-athlete that first enrolled in the 21-22 academic year, and then their five-year clock would expire in 25-26. So the other caveat is, as you mentioned, is 24-25. Would that have been their last season of competition because of the four? So, yes, conceivably, 21-22 played, let's say, at ETSU. 22-23 played at New River Valley Community College. And they came back to ETSU for their junior and senior year. So in that instance, since Keith played his sophomore year at New River Valley Community College, he meets the criteria that the NCAA Board of Trustees granted the membership to get someone a extra year of eligibility or fourth year of NCAA Division I. It's interesting, the language in the waiver that the NCAA released says non-NCAA school. So I think everyone first immediately thought of it's only a junior college rule. Well, based on how it's written, it says not NCAA. So that could help NAIA students. It could help international students. So what we're, obviously as a membership, we have a lot of questions. So what the NCAA has said is right now we're just dealing with the Pavia situation to make it fair for every student-athlete out there and every institution that has someone in that boat. But I think at the convention next week and following weeks, there will probably be additional information on, you know, what about the COVID year kids? What about someone who was started in 1920 and then had the COVID year? Right now, they're outside of, you know, the granted waiver of the Pavia case. But it's interesting. I mean, that's also leading to discussions of just flat-out 5 years of eligibility.
Right. That'd be the next question I was going to ask is, what if they did that? Now, I'm glad you said it. What if they just did, forget the four for five, you get five, but then we're not going to allow the sixth, seventh, you know, try to limit, you know, the amount of waivers and just say, all right, guys, you got five. And maybe still medical, you get a six. I get that. But outside of, you know, multiple things, again, the pandemic was a one-off that hopefully we never have to deal with ever again. What are the possibilities and how would that make it easier if they just say, okay, 5 years, and would that eliminate a redshirt and just say it doesn't matter, you're redshirt, I'll just get rid of redshirt and just say you got 5 years?
Yeah, I think ultimately it says get rid of redshirts.
You're just going to go 5 years. Go if 5 years. You play.
That's right, because as we know now, only football has the four-game rule. So obviously other sports don't see it as fair or equitable, but we as a membership said football can. So, yes, I think it would be, you know, in your first year, you can test it out. You can test out a student-athlete to see if they're ready to play against a fifth-year senior. Because, again, as we know, men and women, you know, grow up differently. So, you put someone out there who's maybe a 5'2",
Why are you pointing at me, Eric?
I'm not pointing at you. I'm looking at you. So, I think ultimately that's where it will get to, that straight up 5 years. But as we know, unless we as a membership or the NCAA says no more waivers can be filed or granted, there will always be exceptions.
So when the NCAA rolls out a rule change like this, which they have done and had to do at different points, so those are different things, over the last several years, what is the communication like from the headquarters in Indianapolis? How long do they take to kind of gather maybe like FAQs or do Q&As with compliance officers like yourself and other administrators around college athletics on how to apply the rule changes that the Board of Governors or other governing entities have implemented when the NCAA makes a rule change like that?
You know, it's kind of interesting because this particular one, a coaching staff member sent me a tweet out by somebody. So I took that tweet and I sent it to our representative at the Southern Conference and said, hey, is this legit? Because I'd heard that from the coaching staff before and nothing was out there. And so this was on December 23rd.
Yeah.
And so I sent it to Doug, and Doug responded, yep, check your email. This just came out today. So they will send out information. Now, obviously, it's you got to be paying attention to your emails or the tweets that are out there to see if it is legit. But there'll be Q&As. We as schools, we submit them to either the NCAA or to the conference to submit them. And I think our conference does a good job to make sure we're all on the same page, and they would like to receive the questions so they can ask the NCAA and then disperse it amongst other Southern Conference member schools. But, right now, obviously, we're struggling a little bit with the House settlement because there's just a lot of unknown. We're starting to get some Q&A extensions. The past 2 months, obviously, Judge Wilkin released some Q&A right before Christmas as well, and the NCAA took that in and added it to their current Q&A document. So we're slowly getting information, but that, I think, is because there's a lot of legal proceedings that still have to occur to make it finalized and hopefully give us conclusive answers.
Let's talk about the other elephant, the NIL, name, image, likeness, the thoughts of that maybe trying to come back to the schools for the simple reason of what we've seen now, all the promises, all the, I don't know if lying's the right word, miscommunication, you see all this. Some of it I do scoff a little, only because I had actually, me, David Blackburn, Brian Johnston, Doc, and I think it was Kay maybe, met with the Tennessee Collective. We met with Clemson. We talked to Georgia, right? All of them talked about the length of the contracts, and now I'm seeing a lot of the players at those schools saying, well, I'm supposed to be paid up in full by November, but all those schools that we talked to were very clear 10-month, 12-month contracts because it doesn't make sense to pay somebody for 4 months to go somewhere else.
Sure.
That's how you hook. Like, that's the part of, that's like, I don't know, it's like a normal working contract. I mean, I don't want to say it like that, but that's actually what it is. And so now a lot of these people around the country are like, well, I was promised this, I didn't get that. And these collectors coming out and saying, well, no, you stay and continue to go here. This adds up to be what you get. And also those schools, I said, what happens if somebody doesn't do what they're supposed to do? And they say, well, we don't pay them. Because that's part of the deal. Like, if we're contracting you out and you have a job and this is what you're supposed to do to show up to get money, then this is what you're supposed to do. And so they've steadfast, and there's other places said, well, X school didn't pay me. And their collective saying, yes, because you had two appearances you did not show up to. So weird. So that being said, there's a lot of talk of maybe what's said among other things of coming back in-house for a couple things. One, tax donation portions for donors would certainly come into play. But two, the schools would be better apt, I don't know if they would or wouldn't, would be better apt to make sure that if there's a set agreement contract in place, that student-athletes and things would be very clear. You wouldn't have brokers also taking 25-30%, where I've seen a lot of professional athletes, like, I'm trying to think which one it was, water receivers, like, hey, bro, my only charge is 4%. Why are you letting your uncle take 25? You know what I mean? Like, the going rate is between 3-6% for professional agents, and you're seeing college agents and representatives and things get 20-25%. So how much would that or would it not help a situation where you're trying to help the athletes get all this stuff, help the coaches with this, and then kind of tie both to where both sides are kind of knowing what's going on and there's not as much stuff. Again, because I don't, you know, you can't put it back in the bottle, right? That's kind of the thing now. You're paying them. They're going to figure out how to do it. How much better would it be? Or do you think, maybe not better, I don't want you to put your own on it, but how much closer are you to maybe these schools having a little bit more involved to make sure that what is being said and done and who the money is going to is who it's supposed to be going to?
I would say ultimately if the House case gets settled this spring, we'll be looking at that next August because it will go into effect next August.
Now, as a compliance person, do you think for the sport, now I am asking for your personal opinion, do you think that is better for athletic sports, whatever, in general, or do you think it just muddies waters more?
Well, being an old school guy, I still think that obviously a scholarship should mean something and is very valuable. But I think in the end, if we're all, meaning all membership, have a $20.5 million basically cap of what we can provide to our student athletes from a revenue sharing / NIL standpoint, I think that at least puts everyone on an even field. Now, again, you can still have your collectives and your outside entities giving student athletes additional NIL opportunities, but I think from an institutional standpoint, we at least all be on the same page.
Yeah. You got any more for him, Keith?
No, I was going to ask, what is the most time-consuming sport to work with? Because, I mean, you deal with sports that have large rosters. You also deal with sports that have a lot of international athletes, and that can come with its own set of quirks. Like, where do you spend your – what's the 80% of your time taken up by 20% of the department?
You know, it varies. I mean, it's so cyclical because it all depends on the season. And obviously, we're in the throes of basketball season, but they're playing. Obviously, right now, too, we've got football that is out recruiting new coaching staff and trying to get student-athletes to replace the student-athletes that are leaving. So I would say right now it's football just because we're trying to help Coach Healy and his staff bring student-athletes in and put a winning championship team out on the field for next August. So, but it comes in. You're right. I mean, you've got different flavors. You've got our international student-athletes and making sure their amateurism okay, but now even as domestic kids, we got to make sure their amateurism is legit as well.
Yeah, soccer I know has been a very challenging sport to try to wrangle in that regard because there are some blurred lines in the lower divisions in Europe, and then those players come over here, and you got to figure out what they have and what they don't, and that can be really tough. So we'll let him get back to it. Eric Baumgartner is the executive associate AD for compliance.
That works for me.
Okay, the compliance guy. I'm just going to call him Heimdall now. I came up with that on the spot. I think it's going to happen. We need to get you a big sword and a cool winged helmet.
That works.
All right. Eric Baumgartner with us on the Jay and Keith Show. Bomber, thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
Yep, gentlemen. Thank you.
Good to have Bomber on the show.
I have a lot more questions.
I have plenty of questions, too. I don't know if he can answer all of them. I don't know. I mean, the way he was looking at me, he was talking about the 6'3", 250-pound guard. I was like, hang on a minute.
But he looked at me at 5'2", first hand, like to you, and I'm like, I know I'm shorter than both of you, but I'm like 5'10 and a half, man. Why are you looking at me at 5'2"? Well, clearly not what's up. When he said the weight, I was like, what are you talking about?
No.
Not 150 ain't me. But he said 5'2", and he kind of looked at me. I'm like, I know I'm shorter than both of you, but I'm not that short.
No, you're not that short. Are you really 5'11"?
Yeah, 5'11".
Wow. Okay, I never knew that.
But you're a few inches taller than me.
About the only way that you'll ever look up to me. All right, ETSU men's basketball taking on the Citadel at 4 on Saturday. Jay and Keith, presented by First Horizon on the Buccaneer Sports Network.